Succession number 28528, Reel 6.
Finally, Tesh was spotted by a tank, which started to fire machine gun fire at him, and he cleverly slid down into the valley again and suddenly emerged just by my watcher on the flank there. So I suddenly, to my surprise, heard this exchange of voices and saw a disheveled body of Tesh emerge and give some useful advice to the priest's guns. But this time the defense, all the Germans had brought up all their reserve tanks and anti-tank guns, and there was no breakthrough at Gubernat as yet. With my leg in such a state, James Booth soon ordered me to be taken back to the dressing station, as I could hardly hobble. I'd hardly got there when the station, though it was very clearly marked with Red Cross flags on everything, Red Cross flags flying, perhaps they couldn't see it, but they could at least see the vehicles pretty well, and the Germans began shelling it heavily. So I much admired the medical corporal, who went on calmly form-filling and asking me my mother and father's name and whether I'd had any pneumonia and so on. Well, my brain was merely shouting, for God's sake, get me out of here. And eventually he did put me on an ambulance, which drove me back to a main dressing station back at Boorada, my old haunting ground. I was put in a small part of the tent with just one other officer, and he seemed to be moaning and crying a bit, and from the treatment he was getting didn't seem to be much injured. So to my shame, I began to feel a bit contemptuous, and indeed may have looked it, because the nurse came up to me and whispered in my ear that he had in fact been exceptionally brave. His company had been attacking a hill on the left of us, and for some reason they had been kept waiting at the bottom of the hill, being heavily mortared and suffering casualties there. When they attacked, by the time he reached the crest under heavy fire, there were only about 20 of them left. They were then counterattacked, and his sergeant was shot by his side, covering him with blood. And when the relieving infantry finally arrived to take over this vital position, there were only about 12 of them left. So compared with what I'd gone through, that was a nothing, and one could only realize that everybody, however brave, had tended to have their breaking point. I was then shunted well back to a very pleasant military hospital, and it took about 10 days, which were 10 days which probably saved my life, because sooner had I gone than the battle, in the continuance of the battle. First of all, our company were very heavily shelled and with many casualties, including the man who took over my platoon, Ron Sturgis, who throughout had been a great friend of mine, and it was very sad to hear of his death. And indeed that changed me in a way, because I then began to try not to have any close friendships, because one knew more officers were going to be killed, more friends lost, and you rather had to adopt more the attitude to keep yourself going of which generals must do, that we were just so many troops who were doing this, that or the other, and not to get too, and many of whom were going to be killed, and so that you shouldn't get too involved with personal engagements and personal feeling. And indeed you had to begin to, you knew other officers were going to be killed, and you had to try and think, well, that's bound to happen, and at least by the law of averages that makes my survival a slight bit more likely because X number of officers are going to get killed, or things like that, from which would pretty unbearable to tension becoming completely unbearable. But one way or another we dreamed up things that kept you not getting too emotional, too upset. And I think that so many of my companions, by means like that, we got by, and in after years we were totally able to enjoy another 50 or more years without any aftermath of shell shock or battle stress or whatever. But I think you had to do something to do that. So I was about 10 days there, and while I was there I heard of the capture of the famous Longstop, which we had been so nearly sent to cover, and which was the main obstacle to get to Tunis. So I was well aware that fairly soon the final attack must come in, even though we'd failed to break through completely in this this penultimate attack. And Longstop was such a legend for us throughout that it always interested me tremendously to read about the capture of Longstop in what I think is the best war record of our war, or indeed Eighth Army's war and Italy's war, by I forget my own name soon.
Alan Moorhead.
Yeah, by Moorhead. And this is how it read on the final cataclysmic battle. As I put it, we might have failed to break through at Gubelat, but the outstanding 78th Division, who fought beside us throughout the Tunisian campaign, soon set the scene for final victory by the capture of Longstop. Months before, we had captured the town of Medjez El Bab, meaning the key to the gate. But Longstop Hill was the gate on the direct route to Tunis, just as in Italy, Monte Cassino was the gate that blocked the direct road to Rome. A Guards Brigade had taken the hill in the initial attack for Tunis, only for the Americans to lose it when handed over to them. The Germans therefore called it Christmas Hill, as that was the day they recaptured it. My company, being rushed forward from Beaune, was so that we could join another assault on it. Torrential rain probably fortunately led to that planned assault being called off. This is how the final cataclysmic battle was described by Alan Moorhead, as I say, whom I regarded as the finest of war correspondents, in his book African Trilogy. The Majerda Valley still appeared the best way into Tunis, but the valley was blocked so long as the Germans held Longstop Hill. On April 23rd, Alexander attacked it. What a legend Longstop had become. We kept saying, once we are on Longstop, in the German ranks too, it was a great thing. When an officer of the Panzer Grenadiers was taken prisoner, he declared, "You will never take Longstop. It is impregnable now." Certainly they had had 4 months in which to make it so. It always appeared darker than the surrounding country and more sinister, a great two-hump bulk. All through April, 78th Division had been edging along the surrounding heights, supplied by mule trains and surmounting traumatic obstacles. On April 22nd, Jebel Ang was taken, and they could look down on Longstop as the attack went in at 1:30 next day. The West Kents and Surreys and the Argylls were making the attack, and by 10 p.m. the shelling rose to a crescendo. By then the Germans could see our troops massing and mortared them heavily. When the attack went in, the quick ripples of noise from the German machine guns sounded first from one side, then another, sometimes for as long as a minute, always to be drowned later by the louder crump of the mortars. It was hot, and presently through the dust, Bren carriers came rattling down the track that led from the hill. The wounded were piled on carriers just as they had been lifted there in the midst of the fighting. They lay quite still, and their backs on their backs, looking upwards, and the blood dripped down on the instruments in the carriers. The drivers sat fixedly in their seats and said nothing. They brought their carriers to a stop beside a line of ambulances, and the stretcher bearers lifted out the wounded and slid the stretchers into the ambulances. Then the carriers turned and went back through the dust to the battle. The wounded were not yet in great pain, as the shock of bullets in their flesh had not yet worn off. They were very dirty, and dirt ran in lines along the sagging hollows of their faces. Their hands dropped over the edges of their stretchers, lumpish hands, turned a greyish-yellow colour that was inhuman. You could not look at it without protesting. Next came the German prisoners, black jack boots, green gabardine uniforms, wings on their chests, cloth caps with the red, white and black badges of the Africa Corps. They marched stolidly in columns of three with the officers in front. One of these broke ranks to demand to talk with a British officer. The Scotch sergeant waved him on bleakly with the tip of his bayonet. When he continued to argue, a British captain who had been tending the wounded came over. "You bastard," he said, "get back to your place." Not understanding, the German offered him a cigarette. Again, the officer said even louder, "Get back, you bastard." It was quite clear that having come so recently from the fighting and the wounded, he wanted to shoot the German. There were many scenes like this that day. The Germans in their sheltered trenches were firing their machine guns until the British got near enough to kill and then surrendering. This meant we were taking many casualties, but not killing many Germans, and the sight of the prisoners did not entirely satisfy the desire for revenge. Fighting raged for 3 days before the hill was won and the counterattacks beaten off. Moorhead was then taken to see an officer who'd led one of the great charges which secured the victory. Major John Anderson was not much different to look at than any of the other Argyle officers in that battalion, he wrote, except that he was only slightly wounded while so many of the others were dead or seriously hurt. His uniform was a mess and his beard was matted with sweat and dirt. This is what he had done. He had led the frontal attack at night up the first slope, with so much fire coming from every direction and so many confusing explosions and flares. The one thing that was clear was that the enemy was somewhere above. Anderson, armed only with a revolver, did the thing that sounds so mundane in words. He stood up in the fire and shouted to his men. They swarmed up after him as men will when they have a leader. He ran straight through the minefield and up through the darkness to where the yellow streams of bullets were coming out. He and his men yelled and screamed as they flung themselves upwards. They got caught in barbed wire and clawed it aside. Some were shot down. The others jumped into the dugouts, firing on the Germans as they jumped. That was one hill. There were still men left, and again Anderson jumped up. Sheer rage carried them up the next slope, and again they broke through the wire and killed with the bayonet. Even then there were a few of the Argyles who had not been killed or wounded, and a third time Anderson ran on until they achieved the crest. Many such things happened during this terrible battle, but this was one of the great charges. Anderson won the VC, but was killed in Italy 6 months later. Fortunately, our interest in infantry role was different, whether scouting forward or protecting the tanks, particularly at night. For this awesome type of infantry battle as at Longstorm, whereas fought by that mentally wounded man in hospital with me, it was the guards who were summoned forward. Our role had its problems and our fighting might be more continuous, but I could only admire those who endured such actions and fought so well and be thankful I was spared them. Once Longstop fell, it was inevitable that the final assault would come soon. As the huge swelling around my knee was subsiding and the pain lessening, my request for discharge was accepted. Instead of going back through the normal dilatory channels, I hitchhiked my way back to join up with my company. There, sadly, I found a new company commander, because James, in that Gubelat battle on the second day of it, in the dawn mist, he had been sent forward to reconnoitre a hill in front, which no doubt would have been my job had I been there. And in the mist of the morn, he stumbled on a German putting together his machine gun, and he was only armed with a pistol. And happily, he won the race to get away and came back, but was then in such a state after that pretty awful battle that he was given a period of rest and recuperation. And so I had another company commander who was a fellow Wickhamist, in fact, but a very dour and serious man with whom I had little empathy and, of course, very little time before the attack went in to get to know my new platoon, which was a mixture. There had been so many casualties that it was a mixture of my remains of my old platoon and those from another platoon, and so we hadn't really got closely together before the attack went in. This final attack was awe-inspiring in the sense that you had two armoured and two infantry divisions attacking on one very small 3,000-yard front, and not only with that mass of infantry and armour, but backed by no less than 400-plus guns, all of which had their shell supply increased to an unbelievable 1,000 shells a gun. We waited for it back well behind the guns, in fact, about 6 miles, but when that barrage started, it was totally awe-inspiring and deafening, and one could understand that the Germans in that small area put up very little resistance as the huge attack went in. Indeed, we had done scout patrols before and found that the main defence, which had also been seen by reconnaissance aircraft and so on, was a zigzag trench up a long, gentle rise above what was called, had a famous Peter's Corner, where there had been great battles in the past, and near what two ridges the guards had taken as preliminary to the battle, the Banana Ridge and Rifleman's Ridge. So patrols had found out that there were no special mines or problems in getting up the gentle slope, and with Churchill infantry tanks supporting them, both the Indian Division and 78th Division had overrun that main position in very rapidly and with very few casualties. So in fact, they had done their job well before time, and we were loose to go through and carry on the attack straight down the road to Tunis. The only worry for me had been that I was told that once the tanks did start motoring forward, they were briefed to ignore all hills or opposition on the side and carry straight on for Tunis. So we had one task. The biggest hill on the plain, not that was very large, was called Mengu, but it was big enough that one would normally imagine that as the first defensive hill behind the front line, it would be heavily held. And my brief was that my platoon was to attack it, and if the code word to us was bread, I was to attack it without tank support. If it was bread and butter, I was to attack it with some tank support. In the unlikely event it was bread and butter, then we could, like the tanks, ignore it altogether, which I didn't think was likely to happen. Anyway, we motored forward with very little opposition to our final or first objective, which was a little village called Borg Fringe at the top of a hill. And we were then told that we were to wait there as flank guards with some tanks in case the Germans launched a counterattack, which in fact they were too tied up and too short of petrol and so on to do. But anyway, we waited there, being occasionally shelled. And in some of the intervals, I had a chat with some of our sappers who were still pulling up any mines, and they were incredibly versatile, our sappers. And in this first attack, when the gunfire overwhelmed the Germans, it also, of course, raised clouds of dust, as did the tanks behind it, and so the whole front was in a haze like a London fog. And several attacking troops, particularly the Surreys, temporarily lost position, whereas the well-instrumented sappers did their reading of the night sky right, but that meant they unfortunately found themselves leading the attack at one stage. And so it was a case of they were meant to be repairing the roads and lifting mines, so it was down mine detectors and shovels and on with rifles and bayonets and charge in to take more of the hugely growing list of prisoners. One of the sappers told me the quite remarkable story, I think, because I'd seen the field. There was one field that was absolutely plastered with shell holes everywhere, and in the middle of this was a lone horse, quite uninjured. And he was saying that the horse must have dashed wildly round when the shelling started. But when they saw it there, one of them went up to pat it and found it really was a petrified horse, because patting it was like patting a stone statue. But they had to leave it to some horse whistler behind to bring it back to life again. And there were many sets. One forgot very often how animals got involved in all the, and of course civilians as well, with shelling, which was often inaccurate and so on. So that was a remarkable story for me. We then had a bit of time spent before we motored forward. Before we'd gone into the attack, we'd been told by our generals that it was certain to go fast, but I don't think anybody dreamed it would go as fast as this. So very soon we were going to have a problem in the sense that because we would go faster than was expected, we would very soon be the only visible targets to any aircraft up there. We were bombed once on the way, but the fighter cover was so huge, and the Germans by then were so run down on their aerodromes that the attacks were minimal. And while one other bombing raid appeared to be forming up, the fighters dispersed it and drove it off with considerable loss very rapidly. So aircraft attack wasn't a problem, except for the fact that a lot of Kitty Hawks had come down just before the attack in a made-up airfield close to the front. And fairly soon they came over us with a Spitfire escort, and the next thing we saw was that they appeared to be whizzing down to bomb us, but fortunately they dropped their bomb in an empty field and did no harm. But we in fact preferred the fighter cover to the fighter support. And on one other occasion we were going to have a situation in which a lot of Spitfires came over, and we were way ahead of where anyone would expect. And as with our Air Force, they sorted it out fairly quickly. They came down and gave us the once-over, came back to make sure, and then gave us the wave and disappeared. And I can't remember any attack ever throughout the whole of my fighting in North Africa or in Italy where we were attacked by our own Air Force. Whereas, of course, the Americans soon gained a reputation for fairly wild bombing. So we waited expectantly there. An interesting thing was that we were right at Borge Friend. We were right up at the top of the hill. And as our tanks finally went on, and the 7th Armoured were one side of the main road to Tunis, we were all on the other side of a main road to Tunis. And when the attack, our attack, tanks did their attack, we were right up there and could watch the attack going in and see the spit of fire from the anti-tank guns and the puff of return from the Shermans as they forced their way on to massacre. So it had already gone 5 or 10 miles, which was in those days quite a long period of advance, and before we were to be called in. And fairly soon after that, I had to attack a hill, not the famous Mengu, which was very close to St. Cyprian. And in another of his accounts, Alan Moorhead wrote that as he followed the trucks into Tunis, he came to another white farm village, St. Cyprian, and there he caught up with, he was pleased to catch up with the 7th Armoured Division gunners, the RHA, who he'd seen fire their guns from before Alamein all the way through the desert and then up to here. And that he was happy to see the gunners there all bronzed and in their desert shirts, in fact, and that these were the guns that had fired for so many generals, Wavell and co, from the earliest of the war in Africa. And in his regard, the finest gunners in the world, because they'd been through everything. And in the desert, they, with 25 pounders, which weren't meant to fire at tanks, they were the ones that had to turn back the tanks rushes. So that was of particular interest to me, because Brother Philip was with those that regiment and those guns, and must have been only less than a mile away from me. I'd had a long relationship with my brother, who had been in his early career, he'd been in the Sudan civil service, and when the Sudanese took over, he'd been moved to Iraq, where he was manager of an Iraq petroleum company, where unfortunately for him he had dealings with the local General Shawaf, who was later thought by the equally vicious Saddam predecessor, Malawi, to be plotting against him. So Shawaf